From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The war seems to be over, but the destitution has never been worse. So these boys, this father, has nothing now. There is no health care, there is no school, there is no income anymore. All income is gone. This is an economy in free fall.
As Afghanistan faces what could become the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, we'll look at how more Afghans may die from U.S. sanctions than at the hands of the Taliban. We'll speak with Jan Egeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council and Dr. Paul Spiegel of Johns Hopkins University. He recently returned from Afghanistan, where he worked with the World Health Organization.
People are suffering beyond belief. Hospitals, many hospitals are hardly functioning. There's not enough food to feed the patients. There's not enough medications. There's not enough heating. And there's a lack of clarity of where the money can go to ensure that people will be able to be treated.
Then, as the nation heads into the Martin Luther King Day holiday weekend, attempts by Democrats to pass major new voting rights legislation appear to have stalled. We'll look at a stunning new documentary titled Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America.
I was 11 years old in 1968, and to my young eyes, we had been on a path toward racial justice that was amazing. There was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. We were winning on buses and at lunch counters. And then April 4th happened, and King got shot in the neck. And it felt like the whole thing just rolled back.
The film is based on a talk given by longtime ACLU lawyer Jeffrey Robinson. He'll join us along with the filmmakers Emily and Sarah Kunstler. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic Senators Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin have rejected a plan by their party's leaders to change Senate rules to allow passage of two major voting rights bills. Speaking from the Senate floor Thursday, Senator Sinema said she would not vote to change the filibuster, even if she claimed to support the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act.
There's no need for me to restate my longstanding support for the 60-vote threshold to pass legislation. And there's no need for me to restate its role protecting our country from wild reversals in federal policy.
Sinema was joined later on Thursday by West Virginia's Joe Manchin, who said he, too, would oppose a change in the filibuster. Their opposition all but dooms the prospect of the 117th Congress will pass voting rights legislation. President Biden reacted to the news.
I hope we can get this done. The honest-to-God answer is I don't know whether we can get this done.
Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the Senate will delay a scheduled January recess to take up voting rights legislation Tuesday, one day after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. The Supreme Court has struck down the Biden administration's requirement that workers at large private companies get vaccinated against COVID-19 or be tested weekly. The court's conservative majority ruled the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, overstepped its authority when it ordered the mandate affecting some 84 million private sector workers. In a dissenting opinion, Justices Breyer, Kagan and Sotomayor wrote, quote, "Today we are not wise. In the face of a still raging pandemic, this court tells the agency charged with protecting worker safety that it may not do so in all the workplaces needed," they wrote. In a separate 5-4 decision, justices upheld a vaccination requirement for Medicare and Medicaid providers covering about 10 million healthcare workers nationwide. As the winter COVID surge continues to worsen, President Biden said he would make another $500 million rapid antigen tests available for free to U.S. households. The White House had already announced the purchase of $500 million tests in December. But those kits have not yet been distributed. Here in New York City, Mayor Eric Adams said Thursday he's discussing plans for a temporary remote learning option with the United Federation of Teachers. Adams had vowed to keep classrooms open when he was sworn in just 2 weeks ago. But up to a third of students in the nation's largest school district have been absent from classrooms this week. The FBI arrested the leader of the far-right Oath Keepers militia Thursday, charging him and 10 others with seditious conspiracy over the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Prosecutors say 56-year-old Stuart Rhodes organized a plot to oppose the lawful transfer of presidential power by force. They charge Oath Keepers under Rhodes' command spread out in a military formation inside the Capitol looking for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, while a heavily armed quick reaction force stood by at a hotel just outside Washington, ready to take action. Encrypted messages sent by Rhodes to other militia members read in part, quote, "We aren't getting through this without a civil war. Prepare your mind, body, spirit. It will be a bloody and desperate fight." Rhodes is a former U.S. Army paratrooper. Meanwhile, the House committee investigating the January 6th riot has subpoenaed officials at four social media companies, YouTube, Facebook, and Reddit, and Twitter, saying they contributed to the spread of misinformation that led to the insurrection. The Republican National Committee is threatening to prevent future candidates from participating in presidential debates, accusing the commission, which oversees the process, of bias. Jamie Harrison, chair of the Democratic National Committee, tweeted in response, quote, "Republicans can't win a fair fight, and they know it." UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has made an impassioned plea for the U.S. and the World Bank to release billions of dollars of Afghan assets that were frozen after the Taliban takeover in August. Guterres warned Thursday Afghanistan faces economic and social collapse, with some 8.7 million Afghans now teetering on the brink of starvation. He also called on the international community to step up and fund the U.N.'s $5 billion humanitarian appeal.
Freezing temperatures and frozen assets are a lethal combination for the people of Afghanistan. Rules and conditions that prevent money from being used to save lives and the economy must be suspended in this emergency situation. International funding should be allowed to pay the salaries of public sector workers and to help Afghan institutions deliver healthcare, education, and other vital services.
We'll have more on the crisis in Afghanistan after headlines. Tensions over Russia's military buildup on the Ukraine border remain high. After a week of diplomatic talks failed to achieve any concrete resolution to the crisis and to Russia's demands that NATO curb its eastward expansion, Russia said Friday it's giving the U.S. and NATO until next week to respond to its demands. On Thursday, Russia's deputy foreign minister suggested its military could deploy to Venezuela and Cuba in response to escalating tensions with the U.S. Meanwhile, Russian-led troops have started withdrawing from Kazakhstan. A violent crackdown on protests this month killed at least 160 protesters and saw some 10,000 others arrested. Queen Elizabeth has stripped British royal Prince Andrew of his military titles and royal patronages amidst the ongoing sex assault case against him. Earlier this week, a U.S. judge ruled a sex abuse lawsuit against Andrew can proceed after his lawyers tried to get it dismissed, citing a deal between the plaintiff, Virginia Giuffre, and Jeffrey Epstein. Giuffre has accused Prince Andrew of raping her when she was 17 years old. Australian immigration authorities have for a second time revoked a visa for Serbian tennis star Novak Djokovic, who has refused to be vaccinated against COVID-19. This comes just 3 days before the start of the Australian Open tennis tournament. An investigation found Djokovic provided false information on the documents he gave to border officials during his entry to Australia last week. He's appealing the decision. Visit our website, democracynow.org, to see our coverage of the plight of refugees in the same immigration detention center in Australia where Djokovic was initially held. New climate data show 2021 was the sixth hottest year on record, with global temperatures rising about 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average. This is NOAA, that's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration scientist Russell Vose.
The last 7 years have been warmer than anything we've seen before. They really sort of stand out. Each of the past four decades has been warmer than the decade that preceded it. There's been a steady increase in temperature since at least the 1960s and really since the late 19th century.
At least 25 countries set new annual temperature records last year. Here in New York City, several protesters were arrested Thursday for blocking traffic during a climate rally demanding Governor Kathy Hochul and state lawmakers take action to avert climate catastrophe. Protesters are demanding passage of the New York Build Public Renewables Act. The legislation would combat environmental racism, require the New York Power Authority to provide only renewable energy and power to customers, and would create tens of thousands of green union jobs. It's been over 3 years since New York lawmakers last approved a major climate bill. And New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy has postponed a key vote on a contract to build a $180 million gas-fired power plant in Newark. Murphy called for a more thorough environmental justice review and robust public engagement process. The governor's decision is being celebrated by community organizers in Newark's Ironbound neighborhood, who warn the power plant would worsen the already poor local air quality and exacerbate the climate crisis. Organizer Maria Lopez Nunez spoke on Democracy Now! Earlier this week.
In our communities, majority Black and Latinx, working class, immigrant community, that's deeply affected by the issues. And despite all of our socioeconomic issues, immigration issues, housing issues, we still fight to make sure that we're bettering our neighborhood. You know, we helped build a park along that river. We have a vision for our community, and that's all we're asking for. It's not anything extra. We're just asking for a chance to fight for clean air and clean water.
To see the rest of her interview, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
One day you look to see I've gone. For tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Someday you'll know I was the one. But tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. And now the time has come, and so my love I must go.
Beatles, I'll Follow the Sun, covered by Ronnie Spector, the girl group icon and leader of the band, has died. The Ronettes, she passed away from cancer at the age of 78. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, the United Nations launched a nearly $5 billion aid appeal for international donors to Afghanistan. UN Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths said without immediate assistance, a full-blown humanitarian catastrophe looms in Afghanistan.
1 million children potentially suffering severe acute malnutrition. 1 million children. The figures are so hard to grasp when they're this kind of size, but 1 million children in Afghanistan at risk of that kind of malnutrition, if these things don't happen, is a shocking one.
Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., the Congressional Progressive Caucus is demanding the Biden administration lift economic sanctions imposed after the Taliban overran Afghanistan in August. The caucus tweeted, if the current U.S. economic policy toward Afghanistan continues, quote, there could be more civilian deaths this year than there were in 20 years of war. For more, we're joined in Oslo, Norway, by Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. And in Baltimore, Maryland, we're joined by Dr. Paul Spiegel, Director of the Center for Humanitarian Health at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. He returned last month from a five-week visit to Afghanistan as a consultant for the World Health Organization. His Washington Post opinion piece is headlined, "Hospitals are collapsing in Afghanistan. At this rate, sanctions will kill more people than the Taliban." We welcome you both to Democracy Now. Dr. Spiegel, let's begin with you. You just recently returned from Afghanistan. Explain exactly what's happening there and how that relates to U.S. sanctions.
Thank you, Amy. What is happening is there's a country in free fall, economic free fall, which is affecting all aspects of their lives, and particularly on the health situation. All salaries stopped being paid on August 15th when the Taliban took over the country. And while there has been some now salaries being paid for basic health care, the hospitals are not being, the salaries are not being paid. Healthcare workers are still coming, but there's no medicines, no medicines, no heat. And what we're seeing are people can't even afford to get to the hospitals, even if there were medicines to be had.
And so talk specifically about the West's approach to the Taliban right now.
Right. We were told to call them the de facto authorities. And what has happened in the West is that they have very hard-hitting sanctions that do not allow any funds to go to the de facto authorities, but in a very broad way. And it means that government-run hospitals cannot receive money. Government-run schools cannot receive money. Ministries of health for technocrats, they're not able to receive money. And so you have a healthcare system, particularly the higher levels, because there are some differences in the lower levels, that are not receiving funds whatsoever. Yet these are civil servants, just like in the U.S. and other areas, that are required to be able to ensure that healthcare services, educational services are running, and everything is falling down. And it's not just the sanctions, but it's also a huge issue in terms of the banking system, the central bank, and a massive liquidity problem. So even when I was there and we were paying polio workers and measles workers to try to get vaccines, there was insufficient money in the country to actually pay these people to do their jobs.
So in terms of the population, the UN reports Afghanistan's population, nearly 23 million people, are facing extreme hunger. At least a million children are at risk of dying of starvation?
Yes. Yes. And I would add that the crisis is already happening. It's not as if we can stave off or we can prevent this from happening. What we need to be able to do is minimize the incredibly negative effects that we're seeing. There's been a drought. There's food insecurity, and all of this has been exacerbated due to this economic crisis and due to the lack of UN and NGOs being able to pay people in the field, particularly anyone related to the de facto authorities, because of the very strong U.S. sanctions.
I want to bring Jan Egeland into this conversation, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. You have been to Afghanistan scores of times since, what, back to 1996 when you were Deputy Foreign Minister of Norway in Afghanistan. Can you talk about how the situation today compares and what you think needs to happen?
Well, there hasn't been this kind of a dramatic collapse in the economy of Afghanistan within months ever before, I think. What happened really in August when the Taliban took over and the NATO countries went for the door was that they left behind 40 million civilians, the same 40 million civilians whom they have defended with a $1 trillion military campaign over the last 20 years. Those were left behind, the same women and children, the same doctors and nurses and teachers and so on. So what we've seen
And I have 1,400 colleagues on the ground. Norwegian Refugee Council has 1,400 relief workers on the ground. What we see now is that it's not the Taliban that is holding us back. It is the sanctions. It's that there is no banking at all, and that the teachers and nurses and doctors and so on are not being paid because their salaries are sitting in Washington, and it's with the World Bank and the U.S. And all of the other, you know, members of the World Bank are not releasing this money. So a lot of things has to happen tomorrow, unless we will see epic loss of life.
On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a suspension of rules blocking the use of international funding in Afghanistan. Some $9.5 billion in Afghan central bank reserves remain blocked outside the country, mainly here in the United States, in response to Taliban rule since August. Guterres addressed the Taliban also.
As I appeal to the international community to step up support for the people of Afghanistan, I make an equally urgent plea to the Taliban leadership to recognize and protect fundamental human rights, and in particular, the rights of women and girls. Across Afghanistan, women and girls are missing from offices and classrooms. A generation of girls is seeing its hopes and dreams shattered. Women scientists, lawyers, and teachers are locked out, wasting skills and talents that will benefit the entire country and indeed the world. No country can thrive while denying the rights of half of its population.
To be clear, he was calling for the lifting of the blocking of the sanctions against Afghanistan. Jan Egeland, if you can talk about the Taliban and also the U.S. approach.
Well, number one, I mean, the Taliban, we need to actively engage on all levels so that there is gender equality in Afghanistan, commensurate with that of other Islamic countries. We are doing that. I met with the Taliban top leadership at the end of September. This was only a few weeks after they took over. I brought up the need for our female staff to have the same freedom of movement as the male colleagues have. No male guardian should ever be needed to accompany that. And I got a yes and a yes in my meetings in Kabul. And then we have negotiated with the 14 provinces where we operate the same. We have started with schools for girls and female teachers now in all the 14 provinces, but we have not yet gotten the secondary and tertiary education, and we need to fight for that, really. But it would be the ultimate insult to these girls and their mothers if they have to starve and freeze to death before we are getting through to all of the local Taliban commanders on all of these issues. So that's the message also to the U.S. We've never held money back from starving people because there has been discrimination from the authorities. I constantly hear the phrase, not a penny, not a cent to the Taliban. I agree with that. It's not the Taliban that are receiving this funding. It's going through international organizations, the United Nations, the international non-governmental organizations, the local non-governmental organization, NRC, my own organization, directly to the people. We have full operational freedom at the moment.
I want to get Dr. Paul Spiegel's response to State Department spokesperson Ned Price describing the U.S. as the world's humanitarian leader for the Afghan people. At this point, would you agree?
Yes, they are providing a tremendous amount of money still to Afghanistan. The problem is that we're talking hundreds of millions when billions are needed. And the issue is, in my view, is that it needs to be twofold. There needs to be sufficient liquidity in the system. And it gets, when you get into the details, it's complicated because the Afghani, the currency, there isn't sufficient supply. So it needs to be, there needs to be printed more money actually coming into the country. My concern is that that's going to take far too long. It needs to be done very, very quickly. But on top of that, I would say in terms of the U.S. can still provide humanitarian assistance. It needs to be significantly more. And as Jan Eglin said, it's not a black and white situation. You need to be able to. It's no good to ensure that women have equal rights but they're dead. And it is such a severe situation right now that the priority of humanity must take over while ensuring that there are sufficient safeguards that money is not going to the Taliban, the Taliban leadership. But right now, the communication of where money can go is unclear, and there is such unclarity that many organizations, most organizations, are very anxious to provide money to civil servants, to hospitals, to government-run schools, and that has to change immediately.
So, Dr. Spiegel, your response to the Congressional Progressive Caucus demanding the Biden administration lift economic sanctions imposed after the Taliban took over, the Congressional Caucus tweeting, if the current U.S. economic policy toward Afghanistan continues, quote, there could be more civilian deaths this year than there were in 20 years of war. What has been the Biden response to the progressives?
Yeah, there. I would nuance the idea of saying lifting sanctions versus ensuring there are sufficient humanitarian exceptions, as we've seen in Venezuela and as we've seen in Yemen, amongst other countries. So whether it is completely stopping the sanctions, I think that's a political decision. But regardless whether it's stopped, there can be very clear humanitarian exemptions to be able to ensure the money, or at least the money flows and the people are able to undertake their interventions. Even since I returned around mid-December, the Biden administration has made clearer some of the humanitarian exemptions. And I've spoken to the field, and what they've said is there is more clarity, but it hasn't yet trickled down to, let's say, to the field and to the operations, number one. But there needs to be even, I would say, more clarity than the Biden administration has provided since in December, particularly to ensure that funding can go to some of the technocrats in the ministries. Because even if funding can go to the United Nations and the non-governmental organizations, the ministries themselves are functioning, are the glue of how authorities and others respond to humanitarian emergencies. And for example, when I was there, there were six concurrent disease outbreaks, yet the surveillance system is hardly functioning. And so if you want to know about what is happening in COVID, for example, with COVID in that country, the disease system is not being funded, and it's extremely difficult to know what is happening and prepare accordingly.
Jan Eglin, two quick final questions. One is, is the Norwegian Refugee Council, your organization, pushing Norway and all of Europe to open its doors wider for Afghan refugees? But also, you've spoken to the head of the World Bank. You've spoken to the UN Secretary General. What have been their responses and what are your demands to them?
I wrote to the World Bank President Malpass and the Secretary General Guterres when I came back from Afghanistan in the beginning of October. And the question was, can you please release the World Bank-held money, which is sitting there for the doctors and teachers and so on that I met, the public sector people, and through UN trust funds. So the UN is really funneling the salaries. And the answer back from the Secretary General was, yes, I can. We can, the UN, and some trust funds have been set up and some of the public sector work has already been provided with some donor money. And the World Bank said, well, we'll do it as soon as our member states say yes. And it's still not there. And it's the U.S. that has to be the lead. The U.S. is the leader in the international financial institutions like the World Bank. The U.S. also has to tell the risk-averse global banking system, that they can start again to transfer money and set up banking on both sides. We cannot transfer our Norwegian aid money to Kabul at the moment. We have to truck stuff over from Pakistan and Iran, and thereby contributing to the downward spiral in the Afghan economy. It's not rocket science to do these things. It has to happen tomorrow. Actually, next week, we're meeting virtually with the U.S. Treasury, and we'll be very clear, please go ahead and give the green lights to all of these places. And are we asking Europeans, including Norwegians, to open our doors for Afghans who may flee? Yes. Unfortunately, Europe is specializing in a European championship of barbed wire erection at the moment, a little bit like it was with the U.S. and the previous administration. So I'm not that too optimistic. My own country has now declared that there will be a sizable quota for quota refugees. When I was in Iran, the Afghans there told me all of our relatives in Afghanistan have given up. They're wandering towards the border to Iran. They'll come here, and many want to go to Europe. I think it would be a desperate situation. And one thing that has happened now is that we have to recreate hope in Afghanistan. If not, millions would leave, and they will meet barbed wire all the way as they flee.
Jan Egeland, we want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, and Dr. Paul Spiegel, Director of the Center for Humanitarian Health at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Next up, as the nation heads into the Martin Luther King holiday weekend, attempts by Democrats to pass major new voting rights legislation appear to have been stalled. We'll look at a stunning new documentary titled Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. Stay with us. Lara Downs performing Troubled Water by Margaret Bonds. Bonds was one of the first Black composers to gain recognition in the United States. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the nation heads into the Martin Luther King Day federal holiday weekend, Democrats have been dealt a major blow in their effort to pass new voting rights legislation. On Thursday, Democratic Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin announced they would not support changing Senate rules to prevent Republicans from using a filibuster to block the legislation. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer had promised to vote on the rule changes by Martin Luther King Day, which is Monday, but that won't happen. And on Thursday night, Schumer adjourned the Senate until next week. Civil rights groups have been leading the campaign to strengthen voting rights on the federal level as Republicans have passed laws in 19 states over the past year to make voting harder, especially for people of color. We turn now to look at a stunning new documentary titled Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. The film centers on a talk given by Jeffrey Robinson, the former deputy legal director of the ACLU. This is the film's trailer. Well, I'm walking
and talking with my mind. If I make the statement to you, America was founded on white supremacy. I'm walking and talking with my mind.
You could say, Jeff, that's an extreme statement. And what I would say to you is, don't believe a word I say about it. All you have to do is go look.
Slavery had nothing to do with the war because they were treated as family.
I don't know if he can be reached, but if no one tries, he definitely won't change.
Land chance took place in this very spot. Everybody needs to know what happened because it's a part of our history, American history.
America has demonstrated its greatness time and time again, and America is one of the most racist countries on the face of the earth. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. Virginia passed a law, an enslaved person's death while resisting a master is not a felony. Would you look at those words, please, and think about the videos you have seen in the past 10 years?
Got fired!
It's still not a felony.
Sing hallelujah!
We want all Confederate memorabilia removed from our city.
We have to save other lives.
It's just too big of a story.
Hallelujah. And this is who we are in America.
The trailer of the new documentary, Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America, featuring attorney Jeffrey Robinson. In a moment, he'll join us along with the filmmakers. But first, another clip from Who We Are.
I was 11 years old in 1968, and to my young eyes, we had been on a path toward racial justice that was amazing. There was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. We were winning on buses and at lunch counters. We were seemingly, to me, at a tipping point where we were either going to roll forward with this incredible momentum on racial justice, or we could roll back. And then April 4th happened, and King got shot in the neck, and it felt like the whole thing just rolled back. Because then came Richard Nixon and the war on drugs. We're 50 years later now, and once again, young activists in America are making Americans take a look in the mirror in terms of our true history of race and racial prejudice. Once again, the young activists are calling us to account. Once again, America is having to look at issues of race dead in the eye. And once again, we are at a tipping point. And the question for all of us in this room is, what are we going to do about it?
An excerpt from Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. We're joined now by Jeffrey Robinson, who wrote the film and is the featured subject in the film. And we're joined by the film's directors, Emily and Sarah Kunstler, who've made a number of films together, including a documentary about their father titled William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. Jeffrey Robinson, I want to begin with you by reading a quote from the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. from 1964. He wrote an article for The Nation as activists were pushing passage of the Civil Rights Act in the Senate after it passed the House. King wrote, quote, "There are men in the Senate who now plan to perpetuate the injustices Bull Connor so ignobly defended. His weapons were the high-pressure hose, the club, and the snarling dog. Theirs is the filibuster. If America is as revolted by them as it was by Bull Connor, we shall emerge with a victory. It is not too much to ask, 101 years after the emancipation, that senators who must meet the challenge of filibuster do so in the spirit of the heroes of Birmingham." Dr. King continued, invoking the powerful memory of the four young African-American girls killed in the racist bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church on September 15, 1963, and two more youth killed in the protests that immediately followed. He wrote, quote, "There could be no more fitting tribute to the children of Birmingham than to have the Senate, for the first time in history, bury a civil rights filibuster. The dead children cannot be restored, but living children can be given a life. The assassins who still walk the streets will still be unpunished, but at least they will be defeated." Those are the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King in 1964. He could have given this speech on the floor of the Senate today. Jeffrey Robinson, if you could respond to that, and then in the context of the whole subject of your film.
Well, I think this is one of the very interesting things. What you just read would likely be banned in any number of states that have, quote unquote, anti-CRT laws. And this is the danger of trying to erase the facts of our history. We can't look back and say, wait a minute, we've been here before. We've been at this exact place before. And if we don't learn from what happened then, we are doomed to take the wrong path as we go forward. The entire purpose of this film is to ask people to take a long, hard look at our actual history of white supremacy and anti-Black racism. That is something that has been really erased from the common narrative and creation story about America. And this film and the Who We Are project is intent on getting it back for all of us.
Let's bring Emily and Sarah Kunstler into this conversation, the directors and producers of this remarkable film, Who We Are. Talk about how you got involved. It is premiering this weekend.
Thank you, Amy. Well, I heard Jeffrey speak, and it was at Emily hates when I say this, it was at a continuing legal education seminar, which Emily says makes it sound boring. And I expected it to be boring. And I also, the topic was the history of racism in America, and I expected to know it already. That's the hubris with which I went into hearing Jeffrey speak for the first time. And I walked out of that room, and I couldn't look at anything the same way ever again. I mean, Jeffrey's talk changed my life. And I'm a filmmaker and I make films with my sister. And I knew, having left that room, having had that transformative experience, that there was certainly a film there, and really felt an obligation to help Jeffrey bring his talk to the widest audience possible. So I called Emily and I got her on the hook and I said, you know, I know what you're doing for the next 5 years. And that's how the project started.
I want to go to another clip of the documentary, Who We Are.
This is what luck looks like. I have worked as hard as anybody in this theater to get where I am today, and I am proud of that, but I am lucky. I was not the smartest kid in my neighborhood. And that ball that we saw rolling back when King got shot, the only reason I didn't get crushed by that ball is that I had unicorns for parents who figured out some way to get their kids into a situation where they had a better chance to succeed. And if that's what it takes to have a legitimate chance at success, having unicorns for parents or just having dumb luck, is that really a country that you want to live in? And so when you hear words, when you hear the concept expressed of white privilege, I am begging you to think about that in a different way. White privilege doesn't mean that you haven't worked hard. It doesn't mean that you haven't overcome obstacles. It means that you walk through the world differently than the Black and brown people in this country. It does not take away from your hard work or your accomplishments at all. It simply says this playing field is not level.
That's Jeffrey Robinson, the main subject of this film, Who We Are, dealing with racism in America. As you talk about your growing up, Jeffrey, if you could elaborate on that, and also talk about your son and how he inspired you as well. Your son, who is also your nephew.
Well, in 2011, my sister-in-law, who lived in New York, passed away, and she was a single mom raising my nephew along with her mother. And my sister-in-law passed away in April, and my mother-in-law passed away later that year. So Matthew was 13, and he moved from New York to Seattle. And my wife and I didn't have kids, and all of a sudden we did. And there's a 13-year-old young black male in my house, and I had been a criminal defense lawyer for decades and working on issues of racial justice that entire time, and it got very, very personal. And I was scared, so I started to read. And I don't really know what I was looking for, but I know what I found. And what I found were all kinds of facts about the history of white supremacy and anti-black racism, the role that those two things played in the founding of our country and going forward from there. And I was shocked because I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. I was born in 1956. I didn't have to read about the civil rights movement. It's what I walked into when I left my home. My older brother and I integrated a Catholic school in Memphis in 1963. And despite having one of the best educations in America, I was finding out this material in my 50s. And after gathering this material over a period of time and being kind of overwhelmed by it, my training as a criminal defense lawyer kicked in. And one of those precepts is if you have a huge amount of information that's really confusing, put it into a timeline and see what happens. And when I saw what happened, the reaction that Sarah described upon hearing my talk was the reaction that I was having. And I felt ashamed and ignorant, because I didn't know this, and I didn't know the context of this information from all of my training and education. And after I forgave myself, I figured I'd blame my teachers, because I needed somebody to blame. But then I figured, how can my teachers teach me something that they were never taught? And that's why I started this presentation, and that's why I formed the Who We Are Project. I believe that America has to have what William Burroughs would call a naked lunch moment with our true history. And Burroughs defined a naked lunch moment as that moment when everyone has to look at what is really on the end of their fork.
Let's go to another clip of Who We Are. This is about the U.S. Constitution, about policing and white supremacy.
Article 4, Section 2, no freedom for a runaway because slaves have to be returned to owners on demand. And people have said that the folks who wrote our Constitution were brilliant, and I agree with that. They were brilliant, and they were sneaky, too, because they said, you know, somebody may try and amend the Constitution and get rid of Article 1, Section 9. So in Article 5, they said, you can't amend Article 1, Section 9 until 1808. This is how important the concept of white supremacy was to the people that founded the country. When they were talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they saw that as being completely consistent with enslaving people. The law picked a side. If you read the historians, they will tell you that modern-day police departments were originally formed, especially in the South, in slave patrols. I am not saying that modern-day police officers are members of a slave patrol. They are not. There are law enforcement officers all over America who are fighting for racial justice and constitutional and decent policing in our communities. But I will tell you this. People in my community, from my great-great-great-grandfathers on down, have had a reason to fear that badge, because the people wearing it and the weapons and guns that they carried were used to oppress us. So the next time you're wondering, why is there such animosity in the black community when it comes to policing? Why is there such concern? It's in our DNA.
That's Jeffrey Robinson, the main subject of Who We Are, a chronicle of racism in America that is premiering this weekend in theaters around the country as a New York Times critic's pick. Jeffrey, the kind of conversations you have with your nephew right now as you talk about the police.
the conversations with my nephew were very difficult because he was 13 years old. He had just lost the two parent figures in his life. He was moving from New York to Seattle, Washington, and living with uncle and auntie, who were now mom and dad. And so the conversations were very complex. The conversation about policing was a version of the same conversation that my father had with me. And when my father had that conversation with me, he told me it was the same conversation that his father had with him. And there was a clip in the film where I called my parents unicorns, and believe me, they were. But they were not unique. There were Black unicorn parents all over America who were making their way through the landmines and the roadblocks to give their kids the opportunity to have a better future than they had. So I think the thing that I connected to here is the fact of the importance of our history, because erasing our history means erasing all of those things that literally are some of the root causes of why America looks like it does today.
Emily Kunstler, you and Sarah, your sister, have long worked on films that deal with racial justice. I was with you in a panel to do with the Central Park Five, a case that your father was deeply involved with. Talk about what Jeffrey Robinson's speech and the kind of, and the way you have framed it, because you've done something very unusual. For people listening on the radio, they'll hear him speaking. For people watching, they'll see all the images of the times he's referring to. But then you also include so many clips of the historic moments throughout time that he refers to.
Well, Jeff's speech, just on its own, his presentation is totally riveting. And we felt so lucky to be able to work with that as the basis for this film. But we really wanted to bring this to the largest audience possible. And in order to do that, we had to make it into a movie and bring it out of the realm of the PowerPoint presentation. So Jeff travels to give his presentation, and we would travel with him wherever he would go. And as we would travel, us and a few producers and a camera person, a sound person, all in a 15-passenger van, we'd find stories of people that would bring different aspects of Jeff's presentation to life. So we could have a real emotional hook through real human experience for our audience. We knew that that would be crucial to make this into a film. That, and incorporating Jeff's story into the film as well. There's some very personal stories about Jeff's personal experience and his family's experience of racism in their lives that we also incorporated.
What most struck you in those? What were some of those stories?
The trip to Memphis, I think, was a very powerful experience for all of us. Getting to go to Jeffrey's home that had been purchased for Jeff's family by a white family because Jeff's family was unable to purchase a home. Visiting his school and meeting with his best friend and his best friend's older brother, who was also Jeff's coach, and learning about something Jeff had never even heard about before, about an experience of racism that he had been shielded from by his coach. Those were experiences where there wasn't a dry eye in the room. It was very powerful moments for us.
I was just going to say, Jeff, I mean, that moment where you begin to break down, where you learn about what was really behind a story you lived when you were just playing basketball.
Yes, and I should say that I want to say that when Emily was describing that my parents couldn't buy the home, it's not that they couldn't buy the home, it's that the sellers wouldn't sell to them. And that's why the white family got involved, and the folks sold the home to the white family thinking that's who they were selling it to, but the white family was actually buying it for us. The incident you're talking about with my coach, Dick Oriens, was an incredibly emotional moment for me because we had been to, this is probably 1967, so I'm in the fifth or sixth grade, and Dick is 21 years old. And we are in Walls, Mississippi. I'm at this grade school that my brother and I integrated, so I'm the only black kid on our basketball team. And when we show up in Walls, Mississippi for this tournament, I was told, and our team was told, the clock was broken and the referees couldn't get there, so they were canceling the tournament. And so we were turning around to go back to Memphis. And then Dick ran up and said, hey, they fixed the clock and the refs just showed up, so we're going to play. And we played. And there was a point during the game where one of the kids I was playing against called me the N-word. And I came over to the bench during a timeout. My dad was there, you know, in the little bleachers. And I told him what happened, and he just looked at me and said, so do you want to cry or do you want to play or do you want to quit? And I said, well, I want to keep playing. And he told me then forget about it and keep playing. You know, there are kids that grew up when I did, black kids all over the South that had experiences like that. And so I definitely remember that experience. And I thought that was it. What I came to find out from Dick is that when we walked into the gym, the other coaches came up to him and said, as Dick described it, we don't allow blacks to play in the gym. I guarantee you they did not use the word blacks. And so Dick said, okay. And he had a decision to make at 21 years old in Walls, Mississippi, maybe 3 years after people had been, civil rights workers had been disappeared for standing up for racial justice. And this 21-year-old kid figured out, my team's not playing unless Jeffrey plays. I'm not going to go to 11-year-olds and put this on them. So he came up with this reason that we were leaving until the pastor in the Mississippi church saw us leaving, figured out what was happening, and Dick and the pastor went into the gym, got the parents together, and I guess they decided to suspend the rule for this one time.
Jeffrey, I want to end the film when you go to Selma, Alabama, where you spoke to former state senator Hank Sanders to talk about the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and 65 voting rights activists were brutally attacked crossing the bridge as they attempted to march from Selma, Montgomery, on what became known as Bloody Sunday.
Edmund Pettus was a powerful leader in this area. He was a former U.S. senator. Most importantly, he was the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan.
Highest leader.
When this bridge was completed, I think in 1940 or so, they wanted a symbol. They wanted to name the bridge after somebody who would send the signal of stay in your place, because symbols are more powerful than words. And so this is a very powerful symbol. Every time someone crosses the Edmund Pettus Bridge, it gets in them. Every time someone sees a photo of it, it gets in them. Every time one sees something on TV, it gets in them. So that's why in the Senate, I got introduced a resolution to change the name from Edmund Pettus Bridge to the Freedom Bridge.
And the state of Alabama last year passed a law that said you cannot change the names of any of these so-called iconic white supremacist symbols.
That was attorney and civil rights activist Faye Ora Rose Touré, and before her, former Alabama state senator Hank Sanders, speaking to Jeffrey Robinson, who is the subject and writer of this remarkable documentary that's called Who We Are, a chronicle of racism in America. Emily and Sarah Kunstler direct it. We thank you all so much for being with it. That does it for our show. I wish everyone a safe Martin Luther King Day weekend. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask.